Tuesday, April 19th, was one of those overwhelming days when waves of people swept over the White House and over us. It is why I call April the month of people. It was the afternoon tea for 3,600 Democratic women in Washington for a three-day conference and workshop. Lyndon and I were up early, back after our little break. The routine of Marvin, of Jake, and Jack, Bill Moyers, or Bob Fleming, coming in while Lyndon consumes innumerable cups of tea, watches the morning news, gets briefed, and gives orders, listens to problems. And more little pinpricks or cannon blasts at the way he's running his job. He remarked rather wryly, "They all want to hit the mule." Frequently, he envisions himself, I think, as a sort of a beast of burden, pulling stubbornly along on his heavy load. In the morning, I worked with Ashen and signed mail and got a hairdo. Had a quick sandwich in my room. Then, at 1:45, was ready for the foray. First, I met in the China room the 9 women doers, 3 selected for their work in Head Start, and 3 in beautification, and 3 young ones for their work in political activity. Was there ever such an award-giving society as ours? They were touching, impressive stories of the fullness of the human heart. One woman from San Marcos who'd had 4 children. 1 had died, 2 were mentally retarded, and she's gone into working with Project Head Start, especially with bilingual youngsters. Another, Mrs. Schaefer, had really bearded the lion in his den by undertaking to clean up the junkyards in Memphis. Had she done it? She'd gone to see the junkyard owners themselves, enlisted their cooperation, even their enthusiasm instead of brickbats, with a resulting improvement. Another, only a senior in high school, had been area captain in charge of 10 precincts in 64 campaign, organizing poll watches and transportation and babysitters and recruiting her own high school classmates to work. She came by it naturally. She was a descendant of President Monroe. We chatted a few moments and had our pictures made together. Then I, too, received the same little gold award that they had been given, to Margaret Price. And then it was 2:00, and the first wave of the Democratic deluge came in, approximately 1,200 ladies. But I went through it rather like a chip on the crest of a wave. So maybe the ladies of the press could describe it more colorfully. It was the greatest assault on the White House since the British burned the mansion in 1814, said Isabel Shelton. But I subscribe more to her line. It was all high spirits and good clean fun. All the guests were dressed in white gloves and their Sunday best and overflowing with Democratic goodwill. I got off the elevator. The first folks I saw were Nellie Connelly and Adele Locke. I hugged and kissed them. The men moved gently into the crowd in the state dining room, Nade on one side and Jerry on another, shaking hands on my right and on my left and in front of me and behind me, saying to those I couldn't reach, "Welcome, I'm so glad you're here. I hope it was an interesting conference." With the usual greetings of, "Hello, how do you do?" Interspersed with, "I'm your neighbor from Lampasas. I'm from Alabama." Or, "We love your husband." Or, "God bless you." That is one repeated over and over. It never ceases to be fresh to me. But then pandemonium broke loose when Lyndon came in. Dorothy McArdle, dead rancher Lyndon B. Johnson, got corralled at his Pennsylvania Avenue digs yesterday afternoon. Everyone whooped it up with the excitement of a group of teenagers hailing a Hollywood crooner. And the UPI said, "Giggling like teenagers, the women rushed up to Mr. Johnson, kissing his face, shaking or kissing his hand, and trying to tell him where they were from. He seemed pleased by the uproar. He stayed about 10 minutes, found Nellie, Adele Locke, and Mrs. Price, and took them upstairs for a bowl of soup. By that time, I had circumnavigated state dining room, the red room, blue room, and back into the hall, and I, too, was upstairs by 3:15. For a slight break, during which I met in the treaty room Mercedes Eicholtz and Barbara Bowling Hamilton and some friends of theirs, movie people, Mr. and Mrs. Troop and their children. He had contributed his time and talents to the Democratic Party in writing and singing songs. Quickly pictures were made, and then it was downstairs for the second group of ladies. How the staff and the cabinet wives and all the hostesses moved that many people in and out. It was a triumph of logistics. I only hope it was done as gracefully and kindly as possible. But everybody I could see had a big smile, no matter how squashed they were. And I tried to have the biggest one of all, to thank everybody for coming, and hope the workshops had been useful. I was especially delighted that there were 24 women from Alabama, and there were also about 25 or 6 from South Dakota and from North Dakota. The biggest delegation was Illinois with 300. Texas with 100 I was proud of, headed by the wife of the governor, and full of old friends. Anson Negley and Liz Odom, a quick kiss from them as I started up the stairs. But it all melts into a sort of a montage. I remember seeing a woman with a small baby, apparently 3 or 4 months old. Later, I heard that she deposited her on the dining room buffet table while she helped herself to a glass of punch and cookies. Later, according to Dorothy McCardle, she took the infant out into the corridor near the spot where the Marine Band was playing and personally saw that the little one did not go hungry either. During some interlude, Bess had said to me in her calm voice that she thought it would be better if I didn't go into the red room or the green room, but concentrated on the east room, the hall, and the dining room. It was later I heard that as we were both converging in the red room, the crowd surged forward, and what the press had been eagerly waiting for did happen. Some damage. Ashtrays swept to the floor in splinters. Presidential standard staggered outside the blue room. An antique lamp crashed to the floor in the red room. Someone bravely rescued the musical score of Lafayette's March as it slipped from a 19th century music stand beside the hearth. The bust of Henry Clay toppled over, but was not damaged. And Isabel Shelton wrote, "Possibly it is just as well that Jacqueline Kennedy is vacationing across the ocean in Spain. The sound waves might have reached her in New York as some of her lovingly gathered treasures were jostled hither and yon. The house is for people, too. And today it was used and enjoyed by them." I think it was at the end of the second group that Lyndon deftly led the ladies through the blue room and out onto the great railed porch and down the steps toward the buses, in order that we could all have a picture made, including as many faces as possible. But that was a goodbye to this group. And with a few minutes interlude, I was back downstairs for the third wave. This time, I did concentrate on the dining room, the hall, and the east room. I find in a crowd like this that it is wise to move as calmly and quietly, even leisurely, as I can, with an animated smile and a direct look into the eyes as much as possible, as I shake hands with 3 or 4 ladies on the right, 3 or 4 on the left, and perhaps turn around to the back and on directly in front. There are innumerable contacts with old friends, Dr. Otenasek of Maryland, Mrs. Rosenthal of Connecticut, Doña Felisa from Puerto Rico, of course. This was the last group, and I tried to give it my best. I was delighted to see such large contingents from Maine and Vermont. It's rather sweet and interesting how everybody gives special deference. Delegates from Puerto Rico, or Guam, or the Canal Zone. Isabel Shelton said, "The energetic president and his indefatigable first lady exhibited some of the finest broken field running off the professional football field as they skillfully maneuvered through the jam-packed red, green, and blue room, shaking hands fore, aft, and in between." She had an hilarious exchange between hats. Often hats and heads are about all you can see in this crowd. You can't tell what hands belong to what heads. "I caught him. I kissed him," an orange-headed woman shouted triumphantly about the president. "I'm losing my hand," squealed a green hat as the crowd veered. "Watch out for that Mack truck," a blue turban warned a yellow cloche. "Poor little thing, she's almost smothered," a pink straw bowler said compassionately of the first lady. "She must be a wonderful person to go through all this," said a navy blue cartwheel. "Why doesn't she get out of here? They'll kill her," said a halo of white flowers. But one of the funniest things was a story, true or not, of a lady who hadn't been close enough to the president to kiss him, and who settled for kissing the presidential beagles on her way out. They are most kissable, those dogs, and Lucy kisses them every day. But when it was over, my goodbye to Margaret Price was really what I felt about it. I've loved it. I really have. I'd like to see them all. I'd fly back from anywhere to get here for it. In retrospect, I was a little annoyed. The papers had made such a madhouse of it. And sympathetic toward President Andrew Jackson. There was a little damage, but a lot of fun and a lot to remember. But at 5 o'clock, the day was far from over. I had an hour's rest and changed clothes. And then Mrs. Borten, the wife of the Prime Minister of Norway, arrived with her young daughter, Carrie Borten, who is the queen of the Azalea Festival, and her best friend, Lady-in-Waiting, brought by Sylvia Symington, with an interpreter from the embassy, for they speak almost no English. She was quite beautiful and very blonde, and with her long silky hair tumbling from under a square black embroidered cap, wearing a charming native costume that's kept for festive holidays. Bright blouse and bright colored, gaily embroidered biscuit and skirt that looked like some old grandmother had spent hours of handwork on them, and they must have been handed down through generations. Each girl had a big purse suspended from her waist. First, we had our pictures made in the rose garden in front of the most marvelous display. Gray hyacinths and tulips, rainbow shades, crab apples in full blossom, last no azalea in sight. And then upstairs for tea and conversation, and it was a very pleasant 30 minutes. Lucy came in and told them how sweet everybody was in the community and how they'd feel like they were just a part of Norfolk, and passed around pictures of all the events. She was Azalea Queen last year. Virginia Rusk lent the prestige of her presence. She's always so gentle and everything she should be. It was a gay, pleasant exchange. And then with congratulations, I said goodbye to them about 6:45. But that was not the end of the day. Because of my own choosing, realizing what a day it would be, when I heard that Dick Dietrich was going to bring John Singleton Copley on loan, the little boy with a squirrel, and just deposit it in the usher's office, I suggested that he bring along his fiancée, my mother and father, the Livingston Biddles. We have a drink in the yellow room. And this was the time of the day to curl up and relax. First, we looked at the Copley. It is delightful. The little boy in colonial costume of the day, with a slightly stuffy but very cute expression on his face. You wonder just what he's thinking about that squirrel, what they've been up to. We settled down to a drink and a good conversation. But Angie and Robin, the Livingston Biddles of their cousins, about the approaching wedding, since St. John's, where she's gone all her life, right across Lafayette Square. Cordelia is her name. She looked very sweet and young and tender. And Dick Dietrich very much in love. He said, she reminds me of Emily Dickinson, and she writes poetry, too. We talked about how he happened to become a collector. It started with collecting letters of our founding fathers and other famous people. I was especially pleased to show him my two Jefferson letters and my two Washington ones. And then I said, but you know, that won't happen anymore. Who of us sits down and writes a longhand letter really expressing our thoughts these days? We rattle off something to a stenographer. We just say, tell Mr. Jones so-and-so. Dick smiled and said, you do. I have a wonderful letter from you. And then I realized I had written him longhand. And he'd given us the Sully. And I vowed to do it more often in the future. What a pleasant life. I don't know whether he does any work for a living. I gather that it is not necessary. They'll go to Europe for a long honeymoon, an ocean voyage, and then return to live in an old stone house they're doing over, out in the country from Philadelphia. It was nearly 8 when they left. And then I had time for a massage and some reading and signing of mail before Lyndon came home for dinner, about 9:45. And what he did at the dinner table is so typical of him. He picked up the phone. Only 1 second elapses between the thought and the action on many of the kind little things he does. And called Margaret Price and told her what a wonderful job he thought she had done. And I talked to her also. That is one of the bonds that ties people to him. Maxine Cheshire had had a very annoying first paragraph in her column. Will rains in Spain shower down on an engaged Linda Bird Johnson? There have been whispers here for days about a big graduation party being planned for Linda Bird Johnson in Texas in June. And some Washington insiders consider the timing perfect for an announcement of her engagement to actor George Hamilton. The White House officially denied the reports yesterday, but the rumors persist. The party to be hosted by Warren Woodward. And another paragraph. Linda and Hamilton are scheduled to take off this weekend of June the 4th for a chaperoned vacation in Europe, which has been timed to get her back in time for her sister's wedding in August. This is the sort of thing that sets me to counting the months until I celebrate my glad release, the tents of silence and the camp of peace.